Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Sam.
And we are your hosts for the Gwaqwadzwin Meekin limited series podcast, Rooted in Gwaqwadzwin.
Welcome to our first episode. Gwaqwadzwin Meekin is a mental health and addictions program located on Manitoulin Island in northeastern Ontario. We focus on providing a continuum of care that spans the gamut of withdrawal management, treatment, and aftercare services.
Participants in our program take part in a 90-day land-based experiential healing process that runs through four seasons of the finest weather this part of Turtle Island has to offer. Through this time, participants live in prospector tents, cabins, and under the stars as they work towards stabilization, connection, and recovery.
Through the years, we've seen a lot of change and had a plethora of learning experiences. Running Four Seasons programming in Northern Ontario comes with a lot of variables and endless obstacles that we've had to surmount. It's amazing to reflect back to our early years. And today we've found our footing with set seasonal camps, including the acquisition of our own trap line, where we hold stewardship responsibilities over two townships of a pristine woodland area.
We've always had a lot of eyes on the program. People are curious about what it is that we do, which often begs the follow-up question, how do you do it? We are often inundated with requests from agencies about the logistical, therapeutic, and organizational management of the program. Land-based programs are really starting to take center stage as a healing modality, particularly for First Nations communities and Indigenous-led organizations. Through all our discussions, we've come to realize that land-based programming can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Now, before we get ahead of ourselves, maybe we should start at the beginning. Gwaqwadzwin Meekin was a concept conceived by Chief Joe Harbaugh and a steering committee made of community leaders. And this is where Dr. Minden comes in. Chief Joe Harbaugh understood that a land-based program was needed to help communities, but he didn't necessarily want to reinvent the wheel, so he looked for a game-changer whose work he could build on to develop Gwaqwadzwin. Today we will speak with Dr. Minden and discuss how that relationship unfolded and where the roots of Gwaqwadzwin begin. So today we're joined by Dr. Karen Minden, who founded the Pine River Institute in 2006 after sending her child in crisis to a program in the United States because she could not find the services she needed anywhere in Canada. Karen embarked on a mission to ensure Canadian families in crisis had a place to turn to at home. Pine River Institute established research and evaluation components to ensure program integrity and accountability. Karen also focused on ongoing research that would contribute to the field of adolescent mental health and addictions treatment, and that to this day continues to serve as a basis of Pine River's much heralded success. For her groundbreaking work, Karen was awarded the Order of Canada in 2010. Good morning, Karen. We're super happy to have you today.
Thank you, Sam. I'm just delighted to be with you.
So I was wondering if you could start us off and tell us a little bit about yourself, your journey, and how you became involved in mental health and addictions.
Well, the way I define myself now is as a grandmother of three little darlings, and the mother of two grown daughters and two grown sons-in-law. But how did I get here? My first career was as a professor of Chinese politics and history, and I loved it. I loved teaching. I loved the research. I loved the travel in Asia. And many people would think that my dissertation was kind of an esoteric topic, but it's interesting how it's played into how my work in mental health has evolved. I looked at the transfer of Western medicine to China, and it's a real cultural shift and interaction. And that process taught me a lot about how you would introduce new ways of thinking and new ways of doing things, and how you would run against obstacles, like pushing back against the new ways or being overly zealous about adopting something new. But it's interesting how it informed how I approached introducing Pine River. So you mentioned, Sam, that one of my children ran into trouble in adolescence. Many kids do, but this was pretty extreme. And everywhere we turned was like a brick wall. So my volunteer work was to try and bring that model of treatment that we found in the United States, thank heavens, because it saved her life and the lives of all the young people who were there, to bring that to Canada. So what was that model? It started with a wilderness program. And it was just remarkable how a very tough, hardened teenager would go out into the wilderness and soften quite remarkably. And the work was done by the desert and the sky and having to survive and having natural consequences. And I saw a very transformed child. In fact, she'd gone from being one of those tough kids you see on the street and you would cross the street because they look kind of scary, to a very soft, sweet young woman. And then the kids were in a residential treatment center where the peers were really involved. So it wasn't just a therapist. It was a therapist plus a positive peer culture, which was very carefully managed by the staff who tried to stop negative things that were happening and model a good way to live with values. And then they brought the families in, and the families went through the same process. And if the kids ran into trouble, they'd head out to the desert again for a week or two. There was some schooling involved because these were young teenagers. But I quickly learned, after wanting to know all the credentials of the teachers and the therapists, that that was pretty irrelevant. This isn't Harvard. I don't know if you'd want to go to Harvard these days, but this is living in a healthy community. They had no access to phones or computers, which were pretty new in those days anyway. This was 1998. And then the final component, which really made an impact on those children and on us, was that they took the time required for not just healing, but growing up. And they didn't articulate the model in that way. It was later that we learned that model about maturity from Montana Academy, which was a different place. But they didn't just do a 28-day. They really let the kids stay and practice living the values that they were teaching, and they let the parents do the same.
That's really great, Karen. Can you talk a little bit more about the creation of Pine River and what did those early days look like?
Sometimes it's too exhausting to even think about them.
I feel you on that one.
They were also exhilarating in many ways. In the early days, I really, and all of us on this task force, thought we would find another agency, an existing agency, and we'd raise the money for them and take them down to Sunhawk Academy in Utah to see what it's like, and that they would build a program like that here. That was a pipe dream, really. I went to look at one of the agencies that was recommended, and I went up to the top floor of the building, and the kids were walking around like zombies. They were all drugged on psychotropic medication, and they were in a closed space, and the windows didn't open, and it was downtown Toronto. And I walked out of there and just thought, no way, we are not partnering with them. Other well-established agencies that we looked at, they weren't interested in this kind of program. They believed in a brief intervention, least intervention possible, weren't interested in the wilderness part at all. And even one of our board members said, you know, we could save $500,000 a year if we got rid of the wilderness program. We said no. And then we had a group who said, we'll fund you, we'll raise $1 million for you, but you have to adopt the AA model from Hazelden in Minnesota. And I said, if that worked for teenagers, we'd be using it, and so would you, and we'd have much better outcomes. So it was, you know, sort of false starts along the way. And then I got really good advice from somebody who said, you're going to have to go this alone. You are the pioneer for this. Just build it and they will come. And that's what happened. In fact, some of the clinicians at the places that really tried to stop what we were doing ended up sending their children to Pine River a few years later.
Wow.
Yeah, that was astounding. And I don't know if we've had any effect on them, but on those programs, but I think we must have, because Pine River was an outlier and is now right in there, you know, with the establishment.
Absolutely.
Could I jump in, Sam? Just
yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I find it so fascinating because it's, when you look at wilderness programming, it's interesting because it's such a novel concept, but it also goes back to a lot of those original instructions and intentions, especially with that indigenous philosophy and way of living. What was your approach in really determining what wilderness programming is in a treatment setting or in a service setting?
I learned from the programs that have been established in the United States. And one of them was, I'm just blanking out on the name of the tribe in Arizona. But they had a wilderness program that was started by indigenous people in Arizona. And then it was adopted by other programs for troubled teens. It was called the Troubled Teen Industry. And they would do walkabouts. And I think Indigenous people in Australia did the same kind of thing. They did walkabouts, right, to heal. And they had these very experienced trackers. So if kids ran away, the trackers were on staff and could find them, but could also teach them the survival skills. So I saw what my daughter experienced, and they took the parents out to the desert just for a day. I don't think we would have lasted much longer. And they showed us the trust games that they did and how to bust a fire. And the first skill that they taught the kids was how to bust a fire with a flint and, you know, a little bit of kindling. And the lesson was patience, and you can do this, and you have to stick with it. And once they got past that, they were recognized and they were given them a leather thong with beads. And every time they achieved some skill, they got another bead. And these formerly tough street kids just loved the recognition and loved getting their beads. And they loved the ceremony. So it was a combination of nature, ceremony, challenges, natural consequences, and wonderful quiet teaching by the staff. So some of the programs were, let's say, less accountable or less conscientious than others. So we were very careful. We didn't want the kids to be hungry. We didn't want them drinking dirty water. So we had to be really aware that we had to make it a safe program and not so difficult that it was unattainable goals, and not punitive. So we consulted with 13 programs in the U.S. We went, a little team of us went down to Utah and drove around and visited these programs. They were so generous with us in sharing their methods, and we met with staff. We also asked the staff, because most of the programs were new in 1998. They'd only been around for a few years. We said, if you could go back and do it differently, what would you do? Why would we want to make the same mistakes they made? And that was very helpful. I guess I'll tell you one other thing. You know, I was pretty green about this. My doctorate is not in psychology. It's not in wilderness programming. And the last canoe trip I had been on was, you know, with a guide and from a pretty soft place. And I probably wouldn't have survived myself out there. So we hired a company that was in the business of doing wilderness programming for juvenile delinquents. Now, their program was very punitive, and we didn't want their staff and we didn't want their model, but we wanted their safety track record. And we used their equipment. So we paid a premium, but we had them run the program for the first number of years until Pine River was established enough to set up their own program, their own base camp, and we had enough money to buy our own equipment.
Mm-hmm. Now, it must have been a bit of a breaking new ground, really, because it's fundamentally different operating a wilderness program in Canada compared to the desert. Can you tell me a bit about some of the trials and tribulations in making that transition?
Well, I'll tell you one anecdote. We went down to Bermuda at their invitation. The government of Bermuda was looking for a place to send their kids. They came to the conclusion that their kids would die in a wilderness program in Canada. They just wouldn't be able to handle it. And so that didn't materialize. But tell me your question again.
Yeah, just some of the experience and some of the trials and getting it up and running in Canada, where it's significantly different.
Yeah. The first couple of years, we had really highly skilled leaders who we recruited from the States. It was kind of miraculous that they had been working in a program that closed in the States. And it was a program that a friend of mine had sent his son to. And he said, I think you should go meet these people. They're a couple. And we went down and met them in, I'm pretty sure it was in Utah. And they agreed to come up. One of them was Canadian and they were married, so they could get here, because we couldn't bring somebody from the United States to work here. We couldn't have got the work permit. Now, you'd think there'd be enough wilderness expertise in Canada, but there wasn't the therapeutic wilderness expertise at the time. So Isaac and Sue came up. They live actually not too far from Ottawa now, but they were heroic. They designed the program. They set up all the risk management protocols, and they led the program. And we recruited some wonderful staff. And after a year or so, we decided that they needed a yurt in the winter, and they built a sauna beside the yurt. So you really had to be more careful. Mm-hmm. And we had very good winter equipment, and the kids did sleep under tarps the first couple of years, and then they realized it didn't have to be quite that daunting. But they all survived. The toughest season was not winter, as you probably know. It's the shoulder season and the black flies. But the kids who went through the winter program and the black fly season in some ways did better, because enduring that hardship really strengthened them.
Absolutely. We always try to strike that balance too, right? About making it too much like a facility or too comfortable or those pieces. And we just got hot water on demand this year at some of our camps to have showers. So, you know, definitely roughing it before that. And we just got solar power at one of our camps as well. So really trying to strike that balance between, you know, making it just comfortable enough so that we can focus on some therapeutic needs without making it completely about survival too.
Yeah. The other thing the program is longer than ours was at the beginning, and the American programs were a month.
Yeah.
And the American programs didn't have to deal with deep winter. Mm. But the Pine River program is now extended to as long as is needed in the woods before they go back to the residents. So it can be 2 or 3 months. And it's hard on them to be out for that long.
Absolutely. I think just to springboard on Matt's question a little bit here, because I think a lot of our listeners may be folks that are interested in starting their own program, whether they're an organization or an Indigenous community or different people. But I know people often like to hear about this from us, so I'm interested to hear about it from you. What were the mistakes you made in the beginning? What went wrong?
Yeah. Well, sometimes I guess the biggest mistake is making the wrong hire, and you realize that the person that you hired isn't a diligent risk manager. That my biggest concern was always risk. You know, I got a call one night, it was like 2 in the morning, from the police. The Pine River van has been stolen and found, and one of the kids stole it. So I called the school and the night staffer there, and I said, could you wake him up? And I talked to him and I said, what were you thinking? And it was just learning from the kids what you had to be careful about, where you had to lock up the keys. also about hiring staff who didn't understand that we had a stand in the door policy. You wanted to run away, we weren't going to make it easy. The laws in Canada are such that you can't hold the kids. So how do you make it difficult for them to run? You stand in the door and you get somebody big to stand in the door and say, let's talk. Here are the consequences of running. You get some of the other kids who've been in the program as peer mentors and tell them the only way out is through, and we're with you, and please stay, we'll miss you. And the vast majority of the kids who were responded to in that way ended up staying. Risk management training is big. The other thing I would have done, I think, and Sam, you and I talked about it with Wikwadzawin, is get the accreditation procedures and policies and all the things that they're going to test you on before you open, and design your policies and procedures so that you could get accreditation within a few years of opening. So you may as well, instead of restructuring a program, start with that blueprint. Accreditation doesn't cover everything, but it's a really good basis. So I would recommend that again. And what we did do, well, I'll brag about this because we did it. We didn't go, oh my God, we don't have any baseline data. We had a outcome evaluation design before we had a program, before we had a building. And the question is, what are you trying to accomplish? And ask that question, what does success look like? And you write down the indicators of success, and then you get somebody who knows what they're doing in outcome evaluation to say, how would we measure that? And then you set up a system. How are you going to collect that data? How are you going to store that data? How are you going to analyze that data and report on it? And that was one of the things that we really did right. But the risk management was really kind of scary at the beginning, because we didn't anticipate well enough, and some of the staff just didn't understand the model.
So can we unpack that a little bit? Why was that research and outcome measurement so important? What did that do for you?
Well, for me personally, I looked at the programs in Canada and many of them in the United States at the time who weren't measuring outcomes, and said, why would I do this if it doesn't work? What if it just worked for our child because it happened to be a good fit? And I also realized that I didn't have a vested interest in this as a career. If it didn't work, we would close it down. We wouldn't keep doing it. And you didn't have that attitude in existing programs, because they would keep doing it anyway. That was their job. I would have gone back to Chinese politics. So I realized I came to it with a very, very different outlook. I don't have to make this work. The other thing for me was the bar was very high for success. And I wouldn't be satisfied with a low bar. And I was horrified, really, with how low the expectations were in facilities here in Toronto and in Winnipeg, where we lived previously, and actually across the country. The expectations of how well the kids could do were very low. And that seems to be the case across the mental health field. Like, this is the best you're going to get from somebody with schizophrenia. So just accept it. And, you know, that's it. And we know there are places where people do better. There are outlier treatment programs. There's one in the Northeast U.S. called Gould Farm, and they get very good outcomes. And they've been around for about 100 years, I think. They get good outcomes with mental illness. With addiction, I never really believed that it was a condition that was chronic, that you couldn't recover. And to say I'm an addict for the rest of your life, it just didn't ring true with me. Maybe it's true for older adults. I don't know. It's not my field of expertise, and you may have different thoughts about it. But for a teenager with a plastic brain, absolutely not the case. You can outgrow this, and you don't have to say I'm an addict for the rest of your life. So it was about having higher expectations and higher hopes and wanting to see these children really flourish into young adulthood.
That's amazing. I mean, at the same time, a little bit defeating too, because when you look at it and some of the pieces that the current government's putting forward, like Roadmap to Wellness right now, still the same things happening where there is no measurement happening across the spectrum of mental health and addictions programs. Yeah. And I know we weren't able to start it right away the way you had instructed me to, but we did start it early on. And I think that does speak to a lot of our own success and being able to adapt our program for things that weren't working or to pursue other avenues of funding. We have those metrics and we have that data to help prove that our program does work. But when you look across the province and across the country and try and get metrics on what the rate of success for a treatment program is, it doesn't exist. Like I've tried whether to get it from the ministry, I've tried to go through a private health auditing firms and different pieces, and they're just that data just isn't out there. And of course, there's a lot of different pieces, length of programs and those different pieces, but there's just not a lot of measurement happening out there, and that is kind of scary.
Well, you know, Sam, there are a few things that I think about when we talk about this. One is, it's such a source of frustration to me that I had to step out and just, I'm not going to solve it, and maybe it'll be solved someday. But all the energy and all the funding is going into trying to agree on indicators and how you're going to measure. And I remember a conversation you and I had, and I said, so are you measuring your outcomes? And you said, not yet. And I said, well, how do you think you're doing? And you started giving me some numbers, like a large percentage of the young people who were in your program were doing better. And I said, well, do you have an envelope, like a blank envelope? Just turn it over and start scratching the numbers on the back of the envelope. And you did, you wrote them down. And I said, there, you've just started your outcome evaluation program. It is not a huge mountain to climb. And then I guess you hooked up with Laura Mills from Pine River, and she helped you set up the program. And Laura actually explained to me, because I have no background in statistics, I think I took 2 weeks of a statistics course in university and then ran out the door. She said that you can take different outcome indicators and data from different programs, and there are ways that you can make them comparable. It's doable. Yeah. It's just, yeah. And
it's just not being done.
It's not being done. And I think it's not being done because everybody's obsessing about, we can't start until we all agree on indicators, yeah, and all do it the same way. Well, if you're government, okay, you might want those same indicators, but I really campaigned to have funders and especially philanthropists make it a condition of funding. I don't care how you measure your outcomes, but I want to see outcome measurements, and I will not dock you funds because your outcomes aren't good. I just want to see you respond from the feedback that you get from your outcomes. But it's appalling that we're funding programs that don't work, and we keep doing things that don't work. One of the phrases which just makes my hair stand on end is treatment resistant. This person is treatment resistant. It's not about them. It's about us, the treaters. It means we don't have the right treatment yet. So change the spotlight. It's what are we not doing right to get through to this person, and we have to keep trying.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, your first career wasn't in this field, but you're obviously very passionate about your work in mental health and addictions. Why is it so important to you?
I saw in our family, and I see in so many families and people who have turned to me for help over the last 25 years, really, how mental illness and addiction takes down the whole family. It's not just a one person illness. And the damage, the pain, the despair that it causes is just heartbreaking. And I think there are things that I can still contribute to, although very much from the sidelines now as an advisor. We can't give up, and we can't just accept the status quo, even though it's inching forward bit by bit. The other thing that has really stayed with me, and it was kind of my war cry, out of the hospitals into the woods. And to see people confined in a hospital when they're mentally ill is also heartbreaking, because we know that nature heals. It's not just nature. You don't just put somebody out there in the woods, but it's a much less expensive intervention. There's a fair bit of research on it now, as you know, demonstrating that it works. Even horticulture therapy in a senior's home works. So in fact, in the past 3 years, I've taken up botanical drawing and sitting. Oh, really? Yeah, it's just amazing. Sitting with a plant with my colored pencils and watercolors and studying that plant. And I was very fortunate to encounter an inspired teacher who said, just sit and watch that plant and its essence will come to you. And it's a lovely, quiet, meditative way to be in touch with nature when it's icy outside. I don't want to go for a walk.
Absolutely.
Kind of looking at a more generalized lens of just that, why do you think the connection to the land is so important in healing initiatives? And what does it do for a person? Or what can it do? I shouldn't say what does it do. What can it do? What are the opportunities?
Well, I think about Japanese forest bathing. You know, I guess it's been a thing for a long time, and it's now been discovered here, or we've been made aware of it. But, you know, when you go for a walk in the woods, the impact on you is palpable. If you stop and feel it, it's palpable. And it's a connection to living things. that you don't get from bricks and mortar. It's a feeling that opens your heart. And even if you don't have the skills or understanding to manage what's going on, if you have emotional dysregulation, you still, people just respond. It's the evidence is there. Why do people sit and watch the water, watch the waves? Why do people gather on the shore at sunrise and sunset? Why have so many rituals evolved that are based around nature? About a decade ago, our synagogue did a major renovation, and they surveyed the several thousand members of this congregation, what's most important to you? And the majority of people said, we want windows. We want to see outside. We want to see the light while we're praying. And so the place now has a magnificent glass atrium, which dominates the whole structure, and has a living wall of plants that is like 40, 50 feet high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing. And I think it's something that we've gotten so far away from, especially in this contemporary world where everything is either digital or we're indoors with the kind of luxuries and comforts of home. And for us, a lot of the program is quite similar to what you've been talking about in terms of philosophy. It's about that connection to natural order and understanding that continuum of awareness and opportunity and understanding, because you can find the peace and serenity sitting with a lake, but you can also find teachings around self-awareness and humility in the face of a big storm as well. So you get to run the full gamut of experience and human emotion and response just through that natural order. So it's something that is not the same if you're trying to create a contrived situation where it's synthetic. It doesn't work.
Yeah, it's exactly right, Matt. And, there's a sense of awe, a sense of wonder, and also a sense that of power, mm-hmm. that nature is powerful. And we're not as powerful. Also, there's a lot of new research on the connection of trees underground and fungi and the interconnectedness of root systems and just miraculous natural events where one grove of trees will drop all its leaves, but the one a little farther away doesn't, and they're actually interconnected, and they time it for a reason which I can't remember. But there's a beautiful book called To Speak for the Trees, and I recommend it, actually. I'm sorry, I can't remember the author's name, but she's a woman who lives near Ottawa, and she has her own arboretum. Mm-hmm. And she talks about the incredible connections. And those connections are mirrored in human connections. No man is an island. No person is an island.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't there when the relationship was first established with you and Gwekwadzwin. I'm curious if you can tell me a little bit about some of those, the first connection and the first experience and what you learned about Gwekwadzwin, how it was presented and how you saw that you could contribute to the efforts.
I love that you asked me that, because it's such a lovely memory for me. A very well-known Globe and Mail columnist, Margaret Fenty, wrote an article about me and the establishment of Pine River. And it was in the national newspaper, and Chief Joe Hare read it. And he phoned me, along with a number of other people who called at around that time, and said, that's amazing, I want to start a program. And then they never called again. But Chief Joe said, I'm going to be in Toronto. Can we meet? And I said, absolutely. And he came to the office and we talked for a while. And he said, I want this for my people. And we want to learn about how you did this. And he didn't call it Gwekwadzwin. In fact, that's a name that I think, Sam, you kind of landed on.
No, that was from Chief Joe Haribaugh's mind, for sure, Gwakwadzwan.
Oh, okay.
But it might have been an evolution along the way.
Yeah. And he knew that he wanted it to be based around Indigenous values. And then I did a little bit of research, and he explained to me about the right way to live and what those values were and what Gwakwadzwan means. And he said, I'll get back to you. I'll get back to you in September, I think he said. And a year later in September, he got back to me. But what he'd accomplished in that year was astounding, from my understanding. He got 5 or 6 First Nations on Manitoulin to agree to collaborate. Mm. And that's a feat.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks to his vision and either diplomacy or carrot and stick. I don't know which. I don't know what his operating style was, but he was inspired and inspiring. Mm-hmm. And that was the first introduction. And then I don't remember the exact order, but I know that he sent a team to visit Pine River. And he asked me, just as I was retiring and my second grandchild was born, would I be willing to do the startup? And I said, no, I don't have the energy that is needed, and I don't live on Manitoulin, and it doesn't make sense. There's got to be somebody there who can be your operations startup person, and I'm happy to work with them. And Sam, I don't know how they found you, but it was a lucky break. And I remember you came down to Toronto and you walked in, and I thought, you don't look Aboriginal, but who am I to know? And didn't say anything, didn't ask you, you didn't say anything. But the way you worked so in such attunement with your community has just been a gift, a real gift. And you did the heavy lifting, and I piped in every so often. I emptied out my archives, and we had, it was the dining room table I'm sitting at now. We had spreadsheets, we had posters taped to the window. We planned, we calculated what budgets would be and how many staff, and right down to the last fine detail, including what would be on the menu. And absolutely. Actually, in between, I don't know if it was, I think it was before you came on, my husband and Harvey and I were invited up to Manitoulin and to speak to a conference that Chief Joe had organized. And we got there late at night. We stayed at the Mindamoya, and there was one place open to eat. I don't remember what it was called, but we had something to eat. And then we met the group the next day and made our presentation. And it was the first time I'd been at a ceremony with tobacco and sweetgrass. It was very moving. And it was very moving to start with a prayer and very grounding. And people were really attentive, and they listened because we told our personal story, because that's how this happened. It happened, you know, I said to my child, who's now in her 40s, I'm sorry you had to go through what you went through, but look what came out of it. She's a co-founder of Pine River.
Wow, that's really powerful. Do you think from the initial vision that it stayed true, or has it evolved into something that, I mean, even the growth that we've seen in the last 5 years was kind of unimaginable at the time when we started, but I'm curious from your angle, what does that look like?
Yeah. Yes, it has stayed true to the model. I pray that it will continue to stay true to the model. I was very disappointed that it didn't grow faster, because I thought we were ready. When I retired, I thought we were ready to really expand the impact by sharing knowledge and doing professional development workshops, and not by so much by adding more than 20 beds. So that didn't happen quickly. But, you know, there's a time for different kinds of leadership. So I've been told I was the visionary leader, and I'm not cut out to be a maintenance person. I like to keep growing, and people were tired from startup. So they had a number of years of maintenance. To me, it was dull, but it was, but for the kids who went through the program, we kept getting the same amazing outcomes. And I fought very hard to bring in an American clinical director who understood the model. And that was a very difficult fight, because most of the staff had been educated in and worked in what I'll call the traditional social work agency model in Canada, which doesn't measure outcomes, which thinks the kids have rights. And I used to say, yeah, they can die with their rights on. You have to stop them from running away. You have to help them stay with the program. And it was getting that staff in place that was a really big challenge. But the clinical director who we hired, Victoria Creighton, who was from Montana Academy, really understood the model, helped it to evolve. And we would bring people up from the U.S., from the most successful programs, to do professional development. And now Pine River staff are doing that professional development. So they've really reached out. And as I said, I wished it had been 10 years earlier, but it's happening. And the number of initiatives that they've undertaken are really impressive.
Mm-hmm. Before I pass back, Sam, I have one last question. What sort of efforts did you have to make in order to establish the organizational culture? Because it is a big shift from what people are used to. And I'm curious, from that leadership angle, what does that look like? And how did you employ some of that that connection and buy-in?
Well, there were three of us on this startup team. Myself, my daughter, Elise, and Samantha Yamada, who had a Harvard degree in adolescent treatment and understood how to do outcome evaluation. And she had worked in a wilderness program in the U.S. And we met with staff regularly. And in fact, we had to let our first clinical director go, because he didn't really get the model, and was kind of disruptive. And, you know, it was kind of rocky in that way. You had to, I guess, as a leader, I kept writing what I hoped were inspirational messages, meeting with staff, sharing that it was personal for me, that we were getting amazing outcomes, sharing the outcome evaluation data with staff every 3 months, that what you're doing is making a difference, getting the students who had been through the program to speak to staff and say, you know, we had rituals for some, you know, one of our early clinical directors designed some wonderful graduation rituals at each stage of the program. And he had the kids speak to the other students, and the parents came up and spoke, and they spoke to the other parents. So there was a lot of peer mentorship going on. And that was as much leadership as I provided. Mm-hmm. Very powerful.
Yeah. Amazing. Miigwech.
I think you touched on this a little bit already, Karen, when you talked about the brick wall you hit as a parent. And I think that still exists for a lot of parents out there as wait lists continue to balloon for the few programs that there are. But I'm wondering if you can tell us what some of the biggest challenges are for people regarding mental health and addictions in Ontario right now.
Let me start with what I think the biggest obstacle is,
Sure.
and that is accepting the status quo. The second is, and I don't know why this is exactly, but it may be the vested interest piece. If you're really in the system, you're not likely to be the innovator who works outside the system. And that's one of the things we did. We were like a door crasher. And we were, I didn't want to fail, but we were prepared to fail. So we tried something new and we were prepared to fail. So funding innovation is a challenge to philanthropists. I would not, now knowing what I know now about how government works, and I was a professor of public policy along with the other things I did. I can't believe I didn't learn this until after I left that field. But governments don't innovate. They follow innovators. So you have to be willing to try something new, create the evidence carefully through careful outcome evaluation, and make the case this works. And it doesn't just work to get government funding to eventually follow. It works in the marketplace because people started coming to Pine River. Psychiatrists in Ottawa started referring their patients to Pine River in the first year it opened. Nothing that they had tried worked, and they were willing to try this. I remember talking to a social worker at SickKids in their adolescent treatment program, and I said, "What do you know about these programs in the States?" She said, "I really don't know about them, but I noticed that we'd have a kid in our program and they weren't doing well because none of the kids did well. And it was from 9 till 3, Monday to Friday. And the rule was you weren't allowed to socialize with other kids in the program when you weren't in the program, you know, after hours, because you'd be a bad influence on each other." And she said, "I noticed that a few kids disappeared and come back a year later, and they were great. They were high functioning. And I found out that they'd gone to American programs that had wilderness and then long-term residential." So I would say be curious. If you're in the field and you're working in something that doesn't work, be curious. Or if you're fed up with the way it's being done, see if there are any job openings at Gwagwaagsuwan or Pine River. You know, I think that's how a lot of the US programs were seeded. People would work in a in an innovative program that did really well, and then they'd say, "I want to start my own program." And now there are dozens of them. I don't know if that answered your question. Did it, Sam?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think it really touches on my next and final question. And the some of the concept of this podcast is to flip the script on Indigenous wellness, which is to say, you know, I think we often get caught up in focusing on what's going wrong in the system or what those gaps are, and really focusing on those, which of course is vitally important. But we also want to focus on those innovations or what is working or what are those new and exciting trends. So I know you're tapped into a lot of different things. So interested to know on any successes or any new programs that you've seen for addressing wellness or mental health and addictions, and tell us a little bit about those.
Well, I'll tell you about one that I'm working with now as an advisor, and it's called Stella's Place in Toronto. It's for young adults, and the model is peer counseling, and it's not peer counseling without anything else, but that's a big part of what goes on. And so, for example, they have a program with Mount Sinai Hospital where a trained peer who has been through this experience of a mental health crisis works with the emergency department and will partner with the team and with the young adult who comes into the Emerge, and those young people do better. They also have a DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy program, and that's, you know, very well regarded therapeutic approach, which I'm sure you're familiar with and maybe use. They have peer DBT, so it's not just the therapist, but they're also peers, and it's a group program. And they've had excellent success with that in people being able to regulate their emotions and sort of climb up the ladder of the benchmarks of maturity, you know, developing your abstract thinking and consequences, developing empathy, moving away from narcissism. I wish, and maybe there is, but I wish that there was more curiosity about programs that are working that aren't mainstream. And people think that it's if a new program gets funded, it'll be less money for them.
Well, I don't know if anyone's ever going to listen to us, but we're certainly curious about those programs. So hopefully we can feature some of those unique and innovative programs on here. And that's kind of why we wanted to do this as well. I mean, we get these opportunities to network or meet with so many interesting people and interesting programs and organizations doing a lot of different things. And we wanted an opportunity to disseminate that to a larger audience as well. And that's some of the work that comes originally, or some of that vision that originally came from Chief Joe Harbaugh too. So, you know, he talked about at some point, you know, because we were one of the kind of first organizations getting into this, like in our area as well. And he said, you know, you're probably going to be a center of excellence for a lot of Indigenous communities. And I know you said the same thing to me back then as well. And so, we do have a lot of organizations and communities looking to us, and we want to take those opportunities to help tell those stories as well.
I'm thrilled to have taken this.
Sorry, go ahead.
For this podcast, I think it's fantastic, and it's a wonderful way to reach out and to share your expertise and experience.
Absolutely.
And I think you are a model for across the country and beyond.
I appreciate it, and I appreciate all that you've done for us and our ongoing relationship. And it was lovely to see and hear from you today.
Sam, it's clear that Dr. Karen Minden has had a profound impact on the initial development of Gwekwaza Mekan. How was it being able to reconnect with her for this project?
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And it's not really just for this project either. I know that anytime that if I'm having an issue or I want to bounce an idea off her, or if she knows anyone that knows about this certain subject, that she's there to call. And when I say that about her knowing someone, it was incredible in the development, because she literally knew people from across North America in every field, it seemed. And she's just such a tireless workhorse. At one point, I was also working with Dr. Minden's daughter, and I would say to Elise at that time, that's Dr. Minden's daughter, you know, how does your mom keep up this pace? Because it's just impossible to keep up with her. She just is always on it. She's emailing, you know, it seems like 24 hours a day, and you know, it was hard to keep up with her. She's so incredible, and I have so many good things to say about her. And you know, it's also led to this ongoing relationship that we have with Pine River. And you know, just this past year we were able to gift one of our 30-foot canoes to Pine River, and that was such an incredible experience, and be able to deliver training to them. So it's really come full circle for us. So, you know, in the beginning, Dr. Minden and Pine River really helped us out and get started with different training initiatives and just gave us different ideas. It's not necessarily that we replicated absolutely everything from their program, but it really helped us just have a starting point to have those connections, to do those different pieces. But I've really seen it come full circle this past year, being able to deliver that training, gift that canoe and continue that connection with that program as well, and as well as with Dr. Minden.
Yeah, that's incredible. Dr. Minden, a heartfelt chimagwech from us for your contributions and being a part of our creation story. Don't forget to tune in next week as we connect with Roger Bowden in part two of our origin story. Roger was instrumental in the initial development at the start of Gwekwadzwan Meekin and has plenty of stories to share. From here at the Gwekwadzwan Studio, we say miigwech for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to learn more about the program, please visit www.gwek.ca.